free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net, where you can see a past lineup of speakers and see who's coming down the pike, download past shows that we've had, and if you're listening live, you can see a list of phone numbers there where you can call in with any questions that you might have for our guest, which today, a special presentation we're doing, October 25th, 2008. We're not doing our regular Monday time. This is Saturday, 9 a.m. Pacific time. We're interviewing Len Hartkenmeyer. He is an associate of mine who's helping us with our business plan over at the New Energy Congress. And we were having a conversation yesterday about the market, what's going on with investing in renewable energy and whatnot. And he just had such an interesting take. I was wishing I had a tape recorder going. And so I talked him into coming on the show here today to basically recapitulate and expand on some of the things we were talking about yesterday. He is a private venture capital consultant on the West Coast, very well respected among those who are familiar with his work. He's been in the industry for about a couple of decades, if I understand right, and very well versed and well connected. And what I like especially about Len is he's got a really optimistic outlook in what tends to be pessimistic times. And so I enjoy having that optimism because a lot of what's going on in the market right now is a self-fulfilling prophecy of paranoia, feeding paranoia, and a negative feedback loop. And if people just get their attitudes positive, a lot of this stuff could just slow down and stop and reverse it back into a positive direction. So, Len, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be on the show.
Yeah, it's a pleasure having you. Well, give us kind of an orientation, just maybe briefly, some of your background and, you know, what brought you to a stage where you have somewhat of a, what I consider to be a very keen insight into market forces, and especially as they relate to renewable energy, which is why we have you on our show where we talk about renewable energy solutions.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Well, I started out in the industry as a stockbroker with Smith Barney many years ago, actually in the 1970s, late 70s, and I migrated toward venture capital and placing private capital in the early 80s because I had clients who liked what I was doing and I was bored with being a stockbroker. I would say that I've been doing some form of renewable energy or other since the early 80s. Financed some wind farms in both the Altamont Pass and the Palm Springs area, and did some solar projects. At the time, the largest residential solar installation west of the Mississippi at UCLA on dormitories and married student housing. So I've had some familiarity with doing energy audits and stuff like that. Most of the money I've raised has been in high tech over the years. But there's always been an appreciation and desire to do more in the renewable area. Probably to jump all the boring stuff. The subject we were talking about yesterday, Sterling, was my feeling for why things weren't as gloomy as some might have us believe. Number one, people have got to live and work, and we have a strong economy. Admittedly, a lot of its members are reaching retirement age, but they continue to go to work every day. And we're also in a period of time when there's an election taking place. And unfortunately, rather than discussing the issues, both parties tend to want to blame the other for some problem that exists, when the blame is probably mutually shared in most cases, and since we have a Congress that's virtually even And it's representation from the two parties, and they've been at it for a while. And so the Democrats want to say that everything that's going on is Bush's fault, and the Republicans want to say, well, the Democrats haven't been doing enough. And you've got to find enough problems to blame to try and gain votes. So both sides have been doing a fairly good job of dumping on the economy. Meanwhile, everybody's in their car every morning or on the subway or on the bus going to work. Number two, the bill that was passed to bail out financial institutions was a good one. I mean, there are some things I wouldn't have liked in it, and some others I would, but we're getting our arms around the problem. And once again, this is a problem that took a long time to develop, and no one party can be blamed for its creation. They both participated rather even-handedly in it. I happen to be a Republican, so some of my bias may go toward that side, but I try to be even-handed in these things. You know, we suffered a horrible lack of liquidity. Basically, the modern economy in the Western world is dependent upon credit. Nobody wants to have a whole bunch of money sitting around and not doing anything just to be able to accomplish jobs. They want to have lines of credit. They want to borrow for day-to-day operations, borrow to fulfill orders. Individuals want to borrow to be able to go on a trip or, you know, business or pleasure and get paid back later, either out of salary or out of revenue from business. So consequently, you need a lot of credit to function. And we basically saw in the last year a whole lot of credit leave the marketplace, or cash leave the marketplace from the U.S. to OPEC countries, you know, over $1 trillion that we weren't expecting to have to pay. Well, some of it we were, but not all of it. Fled out of our economy, and at the same time, we were seeing the bill come due on some really stupid 10-year-old policies of the government to let anybody borrow to buy a house. And, you know, the one set of, you know, basically when you create or legislate that a government-owned warehouse for mortgages can buy loans where the borrower doesn't have the money to pay, make the payments, hasn't put a down payment down, and has bad credit, you're going to have a problem. And that's been building since the 1990s. And sort of the bill finally came due because liquidity left the marketplace. The home ownership market was pretty saturated. We've gotten up to over 68% home ownership, or 70, and we have a problem. So liquidity was taken out, and since the economy functions on liquidity, it had to be put back in one way or another. And it has been, or it is being put back in. It's going to take a while for all of this to happen. We're not going to be out of the woods for some time. But this sort of resulted from the thought of, will there be money for and venture capital for sustainable energy, renewable energy in the future? And what I was saying to Sterling was that the alternative energy area is much stronger, and the venture capital market for these kind of investments is much stronger than it was in the 1960s or 1970s when OPEC to us the last time. That your capital is better established as a marketplace and a place to put investment money. And alternative energy investments are far more accepted and invested in than they were back then. The other thing is we basically didn't lose that body of alternative energy research after it wasn't invested in heavily once oil prices went down again from the 70s surge, because a whole lot of people continued to work on it in the garage. And I'm sure, Sterling, you've seen in the technologies on your list that you study that a lot of the people who've done this or put those things on your list are career alternative energy folk, that they have developed these over time. Yes, they had to do it on a tight budget in their garage, but they've been working on this. since the 70s or earlier or a little bit later. And so the body of knowledge and approaches is bigger. The venture capital community has come to accept these as logical, intelligent ways of investing money because the future is going to require these types of technologies. And venture capital itself, by the people who give the money to the fund, is considered more mainstream than it was in the 70s. So all of these things lead to my conclusion that all is not dead and falling apart for the financial side of alternative energy. We've got a German bank committed to $500 million for a waste-to-jet fuel and energy or electric power project east of Gilroy in Northern California. We've got venture capitalists putting money into algae projects in Mexico from, you know, put together by companies in the eastern U.S. So it's not the crazy weird person in the street yelling, you have to change the way you're living your life. You have a whole lot of very well-backed companies succeeding and moving forward in their research and demonstrating what they can do. And on top of that, you have a whole lot of government and industry wanting to make this happen. So that has sort of been my take on what's going on. Yes, we're going through one of the worst financial crises we've gone through since the Great Depression, but we're not acting too hastily to shut ourselves off from the world. And we have a fairly strong economy, not as strong as it was a few years ago. But people are still making money, profits are still there, money's being put into traditional places. Yes, a whole lot of money got sucked out by higher oil prices, but that's current income going away. Future income is still being made now. Anyhow, that's my... Go ahead.
Yeah, you just got to say that at your recap. Let's talk for a minute about the whole oil thing. I liked how you put it yesterday. Something to the effect that they burned us in the 70s, and when they did it to us again, this time as, you know, the prices have dropped back down in the last few couple of months, people aren't saying, oh, okay, now we can relax and forget about renewables. They're not going to do that this time. Maybe you can talk about that for a minute.
Oh, they're not. Almost any change in society requires a critical mass. And we didn't have it in the 70s. We didn't have a lot of money available for venture capital in the area. It was alternative energy was looked down upon. And there were political forces that said, you know, just don't pay any attention to those people. Do it the old way. Well, a lot of people saying that were the big oil companies in the U.S., the major refiners and drillers. And while they've, to some degree, been as surprised about what's going on as everybody else, they are more refiners than suppliers these days, at least domestically, and they don't like seeing the oil prices go up either. So you're not going to see as big a lobby for let's go back to the old way of doing things from the oil companies as you did back in the 70s. Number two, you know, it's happened to us twice, and people in many areas can manage a long enough memory to remember the 70s and now this, and with Ahmadinejad and Chavez yelling how evil the U.S. is every night and let's cut back oil production even more, it makes it obvious that we just can't go back to depending upon petroleum from abroad. It leaves us vulnerable economically, it leaves us vulnerable defense-wise, and it's just plain old expensive. So it's not going to happen. Also, the government has invested far more money and created far more programs to help alternative energy or to do outright research and help entities trying to develop it. I mean, the Defense Department really hates the fact that they have to pay as much as they do for jet fuel. So DOE and DARPA are spending money on a number of different sources of alternative fuel for aircraft, and there's a critical mass here, basically. The venture capital is looking in this area very hard and making investments. Major banks are seeing the contracts and the revenue potential of this, are jumping in and financing things. And the entire industry is much more mature than it was in 70. Like I said, a lot of these people who are developing wonderful technologies just went into the garage and kept on working. And we're seeing the fruits of that, those many years of labor in obscurity. Now, there are good technologies that people have brought along much further that you can make a good argument for in front of critical investment bankers.
Yeah, let's talk also, expand on the idea of the oil, OPEC, and whatnot taking the $1 trillion out of our economy and then going, oops, the shoulder shape, head and shoulder shape curve that you were describing.
Oh, if you look at the price of oil, if you look at a chart of it, I have never been a chartist as a stockbroker, but I've begun to recognize, though I could never explain it, there are certain realities to these things. I don't know all of the human reasoning behind it, but there is something in the charting world called a classic head and shoulders pattern, where a price increases, stays that way for a while, then goes up to a much higher peak, like a bug is climbing up to your shoulder, across it, and then up over your head and down the other side. It's a fairly symmetrical pattern and easy to recognize. And that seems to be what has happened to oil, except combined with the credit crunch, that other shoulder has been much smaller. And prices have fallen off more than one would have expected. But that's not surprising given what else is going on in the world. They sucked a lot of money out. A combination of the countries and the sovereign funds and just aggressive hedge fund traders have taken a whole lot of money. And I think that OPEC, in its collective wisdom in the Middle East, which is still pretty much in charge of OPEC, recognizes that they went too far this time. You know, may not have been their plan. And events like world growth and need for oil, they may not have accurately predicted. But they know if they go too far, we will all go and figure out a way around them. And I think they are beginning to realize that's what's happening. To some degree, they don't go along with the extremists like Chavez and Ahmadinejad for a much bigger cut in production, because they realize that that would anger folks even more, which is why they, Ahmadinejad and Chavez only got a smaller cut in production. And the basic fact is OPEC sort of stays together by agreement, kind of. Whenever one of those decreases is announced, there are plenty of members of OPEC and others who are willing to produce more to get more money for themselves. Nigeria is the classic example over time. I'm not sure they've ever followed OPEC quotas for their own production. I think they've always overproduced, and they view times like this as opportunities to produce more and make more money.
So, I was reading an article, a piece in a banking periodical that was talking about the oil industry and why it is against their best interest to have prices get too painful, because what it will do is drive people into alternatives, and they don't want that because that works against their own interest.
Absolutely.
Another solution for energy, and they don't need oil. They've shot themselves in the foot, and so the article is basically saying, I don't expect oil to go above X, and it did. It did go above that benchmark price, and indeed, I would say that was a huge driver of interest in renewables and waking people up to the realities of of the pain that can be caused by our dependence on foreign oil. And I know since I'm in the industry, renewable energy, when prices were up above $4 a gallon, we were just screaming in our cells of, we were doing very well in our cells of scan gauges, because people were seeing this as a way of monitoring the mileage in their vehicle so that they could improve their mileage and therefore not have to pay so much at the pump. So the scan gauges cost $159.95 retail. They were just, we went from an average of 4 scan gauge sales a day 2-3 months before things went above $4 to 20 a day for about a week. when things were kind of at their peak. And then as the prices started dropping off, the sales started dropping off. It was a lockstep relationship of volume of scan gauge sales versus the price of gas. You could see, you know, you could draw, put the two curves right next to each other and they would have the same shape. And so that was very much a function of the price of gas waking people up, making it painful. They're looking for solutions to, you know, how can they get better mileage? How can they make it so they don't have to pay so much at the pump? And you're saying that, you know, the same thing happened in the 70s. We weren't as mature. And so when the prices came back down, people just said, okay, now we don't have to worry about this anymore. But now we're in a position, especially people who are in the investment and research industry, you know, they're not going to go back to sleep and go find another industry just because the pressure's been taken off a little bit. I certainly don't plan on changing careers just because we're not selling as many scan gauges now. And so even though, you know, that has been a great source of revenue for our company, is that one product. It's really a bestseller for us, and it's been an interesting indicator for us. Something else I wanted to bring up, have you comment on, that you kind of touched on earlier. Another point of maturity that was not in existence in the 70s, a difference is not only is there a lot more momentum behind the quest for renewable energies, but even the oil companies themselves, a lot of them are publicly saying, we're going green. You know, they're investing in alternatives. They're looking in other ways to generate electricity, bring energy to the planet. They're actually diversifying their portfolio, so to speak, and supporting various renewable initiatives. And I don't know that we had that in the 70s, did we?
No, I mean, we had a little bit, but not like we do now. There's been a combination of the environmental movement, which is part of the renewable energy movement, but the pure environmental movement has matured more, has more influence and power and money, and can move legislation. I mean, we had a bill for a carbon cap and sale program moving through Congress. Both presidential candidates support it in one form or another, and that's going to happen. That means it's even more important for the energy industry in the U.S. to be on board and have forms of fuel that have a smaller carbon footprint. I mean, that's one of the other things I didn't mention earlier. That's another reason why this is important. Some sort of cap and trade system is coming to the U.S., and everybody can see, especially those oil companies that are on both sides of the Atlantic, like Shell, that what the restrictions are like, what the marketplace is going to be, and what they have to do. And some, you know, those who signed the Kyoto Accord and other countries like those in Europe that have other rules that have been put in place have got to do something. They have to lessen their carbon footprint. They see what OPEC is going to do at least every 20 or 30 years to us, and they don't want to be part of that. The next time will be even worse. And if it happens to coincide with an economic downswing, it'll look a lot like the last few months have looked. So they have to do something. Plus, remember, more and more of our oil is coming from abroad. I mean, our dependence on foreign oil is larger than it has in some time. And to some degree, those energy companies are more refiners than they are suppliers. And if you're more a refiner and less a supplier, you want those prices to go down. And one of the best ways of doing it, I'm sure in their mind, is to have a healthy component of green. They may not want to go all the way green, but go green enough so that there's some ability to mitigate these price increases when bad things happen. I mean, a lot of the business plans I see in the alternative energy area do calculations of revenue for them if the mix of green and petroleum just change a little bit. They're not talking about replacing all of it, though we could certainly do that probably in 15 or 20 years, but just because of the time it takes to invest and build everything. But they recognize in the more mature alternative energy industry we have today that we don't have to talk about changing society in dramatic ways in very short periods of time. That if we just get started, a number of the very promising technologies can start to have an influence over time. And that's what's really important. No one technology is going to change everything, and no one technology should be depended upon to change everything. But if we learn how to make a fuel and food products and chemicals from algae, if we have more efficient solar and wind technology, and I could go through the entire list, which I don't need to do because people can find them all listed on your website, then we'll start to solve this problem. We will have a smaller carbon footprint. We will have less CO2 released into the air. I mean, some of our technologies will go abroad and help to mitigate natural gas venting and flaring abroad, which will make Al Gore very happy. And so there is a... And also, some of the technologies being developed integrate well with our existing infrastructure. I mean, there are folks working on not only efficiently and quickly producing biomass from algae, but also about being able to convert that biomass into a green crude that can go through existing refineries. So infrastructure expenses of the past are not wasted, and you have refineries that are much cleaner because they don't have some of the minerals and metals in green crude that you would have in petroleum. So I think there's a more mature approach from both sides. There's financing to make it happen. There's the greed factor because it'll make everybody money, and it'll make us a stronger economy because, you know, basically the price of oil, the price of energy, is in every product we eat and every service we receive. So if you could take oil back, or gasoline, or whatever you want to call the bio-derived fuel that you're using, back down to 50 cents a gallon, you could wipe out inflation, and you could have a more stable basis for an economy. So I think, you know, a couple of heavy shocks from the OPEC boys have woken up a lot of people over the last 30 years and put us in a position where we can more realistically proceed forward without too much hate, blame, and judgment. It's just something we all have to do. I tend to take the approach in life that the people who proclaim absolutes are virtually always wrong. And the guys who say, let's improve things by doing this, that, and that, are usually the ones who are right. And the investment community, in its thought process, while not taking that position, takes a, well, how can we make money? How can we gain market share? How can we succeed? And to some degree, that's the same set of answers as you would have to the question, how do we make things better? And consequently, green has enough of those right answers now, making things better, lowering costs, cleaning the environment, both air, water, and ground, and moving forward, and helping to lower costs, helping to do everything that we want to do, even if we're not thinking about it, and helping us to basically have a solution rather than a reason to argue and yell at each other.
In terms of where we just about went, or even where we could yet go in terms of a market collapse, a cataclysmic collapse where we get below a certain threshold where people are not going to work, people are not able to buy their the basic needs, food, shelter, and you start having rioting, looting, and you have a total meltdown where you go to a martial law type of scenario where you've got military in the streets and life as we know it basically comes screeching to a halt. That's what I would consider a meltdown.
Yep.
Where the value of the dollar goes almost goes to zero, where it's worth. You know, I've had friends. You know, 10 years ago when I was into more of a eschatological worldview, looking at the end times, preparing for such a meltdown, and basically hunkering down to survive it, so that you know we could be part of a new society that emerges on the back end. Because we were prepared and we survived, and so we then become kind of the new thing that emerges with the new idea. And those in that camp, there were a number of people who had visions of people burning $20 bills to start a fire, because that's about as much as it was worth. It was the value of the dollar had gone down so low, and In the scenario of, you know, with the market coming down at the rate it has and the panic that was starting to set in, you know, I was feeling it personally. And as this bailout thing came along, and it seemed to get, you know, pump a little breather, a little buffer, extending or prolonging the bubble, it might burst even more, and the fall might be more severe, which what Ron Paul basically said is, yeah, this will give us more time, but it's not going to solve the basic problems of the fiat money system and whatnot, that creates this artificial situation. And you know, I'm not articulate enough and knowledgeable enough in the financial arena to reiterate his points of view, but they're very keen, and he is recognized as one of the most astute and realistic people when it comes to understanding the monetary policy and what we should be doing as opposed to what we are doing. He was a great presidential candidate. I wish he was still running so we'd have somebody to vote for that we feel good about and not scratching our heads. Anyway, that does not get into politics. But as we were given a bit of a breather, and things didn't just continue to go downhill at like off a cliff rate, as they were for several days, you know, from a renewable energy point of view, we've had some really amazing developments news-wise in the last few days. Blacklight Power, which has a solution that could be much cheaper, 1 cent per kilowatt hour as opposed to 4 cents for coal. Their Hydrino technology, which is 12 to 18 months from commercialization, they have a 50-kilowatt prototype that was replicated by Rowan University. And that was the announcement this last week. That's a huge breakthrough. Another one is I've been in communication with a company down in Brazil who has a electromagnetic motor technology where they think they're harnessing cosmic energy or energy from the vacuum of space, zero-point energy, whatever you want to call it. There's some kind of external energy being harvested in the process of running their motor, where they're pulling in more energy than what is accounted for by traditional physics. There's some new physics going on. So they do this demonstration. They were in Los Angeles last month and in San Diego, showing this thing off for about a week and a half here in the States. And the way they would show it is they take this fan that normally would take 50 watts to turn it at, say, 1,100 RPMs. You know, to blow that much air takes that much energy on a traditional paradigm motor. And they would show the one motor on the one hand and how much energy it would take. And then on the other hand, here's their motor turning the same fan, the same speed, but only consuming 12 watts. And then when I interviewed them a week this last Monday, they said they got it down to 3.7 watts. They're consuming, they're down 93% of the energy consumption of a normal motor. And they're now willing to open source this thing. We're in process right now of they're pulling together the plans. They're going to convey it to us. We're going to post it on our site, and they're going to post it on their site to allow people to build this thing and then improve on the design and work on the different applications. You know, they will be selling the plans. That's one way that we'll be financing the rolling out and advancing this technology and taking some units commercial. But that's a major development. Another one is this Litro Energy company that has this these little microspheres that fluoresce. They have tritium inside alongside of a fluorescing compound in these little tiny beads that are like 1/25th of a millimeter. They're so tiny, and these things will fluoresce for 20 years with a half-life of 12 years. So after 12 years, they're half as bright as they would be today. And you then combine that with a solar technology, and you alternate layers their fluorescer right next to a thin film solar sheet, and then nanotechnology, and then you have another layer of their stuff. You basically make a generator of electricity, a constant output that, rather than being like a battery that goes down in a few hours of use, this thing goes down in 20 years with a half-life of 12 years. So it's, you know, half its power in 12 years as it is today. So you engineer the battery or this generator to go along with your device so that, say, you anticipate your device, whether it's a laptop computer, you want it to last, you know, 5 years, your battery or this generator would have enough juice to have enough at 10 years or 5 years. It's got enough juice yet to power your battery, power the laptop. So, you know, that's exciting technology. And they submitted this to the NASA clean, or what was it? I can't remember the name of the prize, but they, within a week, were already jumped up to near first place in their popularity. They won it last year. They, with their fluorescing technology, they won this NASA prize, and looks like they may win yet again this year. Now the skeptic would say, well, you know, that's inefficient technology. You've got very low level of light trying to light an already inefficient solar panel, where the solar panel will do well with sun, but if you've got this little less than 40 watt output fluorescing technology, you know, that's not going to go very far, and then you got the cost of both, and you multiply the inefficiencies, you know, you're talking $50 a watt, and that's not going to be cost effective for hardly anyone. But the guys that are promoting this tend to think that it's, you know, worthwhile technology. The point I'm trying to make is that just in the last week, we have had a flurry of major breakthroughs, and it's almost as if this little extra time we're being given is being put to very good use to give us a buffer, to give us some hope that we don't have to completely collapse, that there is a new thing coming along, an abundance of energy that can make life much more easy, affordable, and that we can salvage society. We don't have to go to a major meltdown scenario.
Well, let me jump in there and make a couple of comments. The world is very different than it was at the time of the Great Depression. There is more international trade than ever before. And I happen to be a believer in free trade, that it allows where something can be most efficiently and inexpensively produced to be made there and traded somewhere else, so that one fights inflation and lets people do what they do best. I know all the arguments against that, but I think it's a very good model. One of the greatest mistakes we made after the market fell in 1929 was to destroy free trade and to break up investment banks and commercial banks. And we're actually doing the opposite of that this time. We are putting back commercial banking and investment banking into one entity, with brokerage firms buying commercial banks and vice versa. And number two, we are not trying to end free trade. And there are people who have to play the game more fairly. We let their things in with no tariff, and they don't let ours in. But that's a problem to be solved, and not a reason to destroy free trade and make things be produced in the most inefficient place by the people who would least like to do it, because they can't get it from somewhere else. Number two, we're a far more integrated world than we were before. Number three, I think we have a better understanding of what happened to the Depression, in the Depression. Bernanke is a student of that and has written an excellent book on it, which I really think everybody who wants to understand what's going on ought to read. So we have some really good people, and Bernanke and Paulson, overseeing this problem. But like I said before, different elements caused it. We didn't have the liquidity that we do now. Even though we suffered a big loss of liquidity, we still have far more available than on a per capita basis than we did in 1929. And so consequently, we're in a better position to be able to weather it. Also, people are more important in an economy than anything else. If people have some confidence, to go back to your original point about self-fulfilling prophecy, they're going to continue to work and produce, and you won't have a problem. Lower tax rates, which we've had since the 80s, have allowed people to be more economically stable individually. You can argue about how they've spent their money, but they've gotten what they want. And a happier person is a more stable person, which, for some reason, people still don't get. This economy is made up of the work of 200-odd million working people, and the interaction that increases the value of what they're doing. And you cannot substitute anything else for that. Big government, huge welfare programs, just don't solve the problem. It's people getting up every morning and wanting to go to work and do things they enjoy that makes it all work. And we have that. We're putting back together a financial machine in this country that will be stronger than it was before. I mean, investment banking and commercial banking ought to be together. Sure, there has to be good regulation and division of responsibility. And I know that there are a lot of people who don't like this bailout package because they view it as socialism. I think those people ought to go back and read the definition of socialism and so get a few good books on it, because then they'll realize it isn't. Unfortunately, the government is going to have to fix this problem because they helped cause it. By telling mortgage companies or banks that they would buy, through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, mortgages on houses owned by people who couldn't make a down payment, couldn't make the regular payments, and didn't have adequate credit, the federal government caused this problem, mainly in the 1990s, and Barney Frank and Bill Clinton went along with it. And so I don't think it's unreasonable in a world where we at least in Western society, put a great degree of importance on individual responsibility for the government, if it screws up, to not have to fix it. And so that's my position on the bailout package. It probably never would have been necessary if the government had not made a mistake to begin with. As far as alternative energy, in this climate, thank God for thousands of people who have spent time in their garages perfecting what they started thinking about because of the crisis with OPEC in the 1970s. We are much more further along, not because of government programs, although there have been some useful subsidies and credits here and there, but we're basically in a better situation to capitalize and closer to maturity because these guys did it. And that's a large percentage of the folks who regularly look at your webpage and contribute. But they've done that, both from academia and from the garage and from just people coming up with good ideas. So it's the strength, intelligence, and endurance of those individuals that's going to make all of this succeed. Also, there's going to be, even though venture capital has cut back on its spending because it's had less money to spend, because fewer investments have come into them, they are making the investments, and as we get our way out of this mess, they'll make more. I mean, my principal fear has been tax policy going in the wrong direction after the election. Because whether we like it or not, no matter how much we like to ridicule and criticize the wealthy, The majority of venture capital comes from the wealthy, either wealthy individuals or wealthy companies. You know, they've got to make sure they've got the reserves. They've got to make sure they have the money to operate. They have to update things. They have to move forward. They have to have health benefits. But if they've got profits over and above what they would normally plan for, whether you be GE or a wealthy Silicon Valley entrepreneur, then you'll think about venture capital because that's, though it's the greatest risk, it's the greatest potential reward. And sure, plenty of them will fail. Now, I've forgotten the standards that everybody uses, and they probably changed in the last 2 months. But nobody ever expected over 25% of their venture capital investing to succeed. But one success makes up for all the losses and makes good money, and they're willing to do it. If we increase the taxes on the quote-unquote wealthy, Barack Obama's favorite 5% target these days, venture capital dries up. And that's what we need. Although it won't dry up completely. I mean, there's no absolutist position there. But it will decrease in quantity, and therefore there will be less money to invest in these new venture capital ideas. Now, I was happy to hear that the philosophy on startups from Obama was no capital gains tax on startup young company investments. Now, who knows whether that will ever find its way into a bill. I know a lot of stuff is spaghetti being thrown at a refrigerator door right now to try to get an extra two or three voters on your side. But, you know, one of the other great things about the period since the 80s in tax policy has been relative stability. Yes, Bill Clinton raised some taxes. George Sr. raised some taxes, but not much. And George Bush lowered taxes, but not a whole lot. And there was more money around to do these things. And that has been good. I don't want to get back into a cycle of administrations changing every 4 years and tax policy changing radically every 4 years. What this economy needs is stability more than anything else. And talk of big change always scares folks. And that's why I think the solutions being taken right now to stabilize the economy are good. It's let's put money back into where people are used to seeing it, allow banks to make loans, make sure the lending is there for all the big companies. Then we've provided some stability with which to move forward. Radical change usually scares people, reasonably or unreasonably, depending upon the issue. But If you bring some stability, yes, you're going to be able to borrow. Yes, you're going to be able to sell your commercial paper to a bank and get the money to do business. Yes, your banker will still be there. Yes, all of that. That tends to calm things. Big change scares people. And if the government overreacted, put draconian laws in place, that scare people even more, which is a lot of what happened in the early 1930s. So I think that as long as the guys who've made the progress in venture in alternative energy can get the investments, government subsidies, support, credits, whatever, and move forward, and the economy will stay relatively stable because a lot of money has been pumped into it, we can slowly move out of this. Like I said, it's not going to be overnight, but it's not going to take forever.
Maybe you can help me understand something that doesn't make sense to me. They talk about, are we in a recession? Are we headed to recession? When from on the ground, it looks like no duh. Of course we're in a recession. We're not only in a recession, we're close to a depression. And I understand that some of that is politics and posturing on the part of the government to not scare people, but where I especially scratch my head on it is when you hear in a stock market context that the stock market drops, in the triple digits because of reports that Britain might be going into a recession. They dropped 1.5 three points or something like that in their on their growth, or I don't know how that's worded, but I would think that people in the stock market would be a little bit more rooted and a little bit more resilient and not so flighty. They almost act like a school of fish, all going swimming in one direction because everyone else is. It seems kind of immature to me. Maybe you can help us understand why that's the case, and why the back, or the they're being so political about the phrase recession.
Well, basically, recession has a generic definition of things are getting worse, but not as bad as a depression. But there's a technical definition, and that's a decreasing GNP for a number of quarters. Some prefer to say two quarters, some prefer to say three. We haven't had that. Our gross domestic product has continued to increase, albeit by not as great a rate as it did last year or the year before. So you've got a technical definition, which we have not fallen into. And we have a, do I feel better than I did 4 years ago or not? The campaign phrase from 1980. So the technician will tell you we're not in it. But obviously, depending upon the definition you have as an individual, you may or may not be. And if there are enough people having problems, they're going to feel it and they're going to say it. Now, there's the political aspect of, do you feel better off than you felt 4 years ago or 8 years ago, which Barack Obama is using right now in his stump speeches. The problem is that people have more things to complain about. Gas prices are higher, harder to get credit. You can't get a house as easily as you could a year ago or 2 years ago, and there are a lot of people who will complain and say that means we're in a recession. But we're still producing more, and we're more efficient. And high tech led to that. They have, you know, the computer and all of the various technologies that came from the personal computer and its greater manifestations in companies have made everybody in the economy more productive. And, you know, because we work that we would have delegated to another person that was menial. Is now being done by the computer, so you're freer to do more things yourself. So the individual can produce more in a day. That's one of the great reasons why our economy has become as resilient as it is, because everybody's more productive. Individuals may not feel as well off, but remember, everybody's going through this. We still pay less for gasoline than they do in Europe, and I could give you a host of reasons like that. So, yes, there's a technical versus a general field of people, and you have politicians who want to gain office or change policies who are going to sit around and repeat every bad example of the story they've heard to try and make you feel that things are truly horrible and a great change is needed. And so you want to vote for them. So we are suffering from a dual attack. Some bad things have taken place. Results of previous mistakes are coming back to roost, and they've got to be fixed. And we've got some economic downturns we don't like. And the politicians are running for office. I mean, there was a great speech in the Michael Douglas's President movie. I've forgotten what the name of the movie is, where he comes to the press room and gives a speech to all of the press about how you win elections. I am a Republican. He's a Democrat. I happen to agree with that speech completely, that you generally try and make things look as worse as you can to get elected. And when you have that combined with a couple of other things and a slower economy than you had before, it's really easy to make that pessimistic speech and get everybody to believe it, because nobody seems to have a memory past 6 months ago.
Yeah. We've got about just a few seconds left in the show here, and I want to end on a note of what is what is renewable energy going to do? What does it have the potential to do in terms of salvaging what's happening?
Well, I think that a lot of the technology are close enough to implementation that we can start doing anything. I'm not going to say that it's going to solve everything in 6 months. I don't know of many things that are. But renewable energy is far enough along, and big enough amounts of money have been invested in it. It's beginning to provide jobs in significant number to build test bed facilities, pilot plants, and stuff like that. It promises lower energy costs in the future, which will do a decent job, I think, of keeping OPEC in line for a while, because they realize if they let the prices go up again, they're truly dooming themselves. Right now, the question is no longer do we do alternative energy or not. The question is how much do we do? And if OPEC lets prices go up again, we do more and marginalize them more.
Well, Len, I appreciate you coming on the show and talking. I wish we had, this time has flown by. I had a number of other questions I wanted to address, but we'll have to just put that off to another day or just have that in another form. It's been very informative. It's been a delight talking to you. Thanks for coming on.
Okay, thank you.
Listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at PESWiki.com. That's PESWiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.